What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another brand new installment of Renegades Reviews, exclusively here as always on the Costa D18 Studios channel. I, of course, am your host, the Renegade JJ Williams. And today's episode will also be replayed 1 hour later on the Jeff Meacham Network, as it always is on the Fridays where they do not bring you the dads, not always on wrestling. Thank you very much, Mr. Meacham, for allowing us to invade the time slot. And today, even though it's not a Dad's Not Always on Wrestling episode, it is a Casa D18 Studios reunion, as myself, the West Coast professor, Jeff Meacham, and the stat boy himself, Mike Caldwell, have all come together to discuss 2013's Saving Mr. Banks, starring Emma Thompson, Tom Hanks, Annie Rose Buckley, Colin Farrell, Ruth Wilson, Paul Giamatti, Bradley Whitford, Jason Schwartzman, BJ Novak, Kathy Baker, Melanie Paxson, and Rachel Griffiths. What's going on, everybody? Thank you for joining me here once again for another brand new installment of Renegades Reviews. And today's is going to be a doozy, man. Like I told you in the introduction, it's a Casa D18 Studios reunion. Myself, the West Coast professor, Jeff Meacham, the stat boy, Mike Caldwell, all here to discuss Saving Mr. Banks. But before I bring them in, let me just run through the synopsis of the film like I always do. And our movie opens in London in the year 1961. As agent Dermond Russell tries to urge the financially strapped author P.L. Travers to travel to Los Angeles, California, in order to meet with Walt Disney, who has tried to pursue the film rights to her books, Mary Poppins, for 20 years, after having promised his daughters that he would produce a film based on those books. However, Travers has steadfastly resisted Walt's efforts, fearing what he will do with her characters. With Travers having written nothing new and her book royalties having dried up as a result, she is at the risk of losing her house. Russell reminds her that Walt has agreed to two major stipulations: no animation and script approval, before Travers finally relents and agrees to go meet with Walt Disney. Now, through flashbacks which are interjected throughout the entirety of the film, we are shown Pamela's difficult childhood in Ellora, Queensland, Australia, in the year 1906, which became much of the inspiration for Mary Poppins. Now, Pamela, whose real name is Helen Goff, idolized her loving and imaginative father, Travers Goff, but his chronic alcoholism resulted in repeated dismissals from his jobs, strained his marriage to his wife, Margaret, and caused Margaret to even attempt suicide. Now, Travers Goff died from tuberculosis when Helen was only 7 years old. And prior to his death, Aunt Ellie, who was Margaret's stern yet practical sister, came to live with the family and promised to fix everything. Ellie later served as the main inspiration for the Mary Poppins character. Now, back in 1961, P.L. Travers arrives in Los Angeles and is annoyed by what she perceives is the city's unreality and the overly perky inhabitants, which is personified by her friendly limousine driver, Ralph. When she arrives at the Walt Disney Studios in Burbank, Travers meets the creative team, who are responsible for developing Mary Poppins for the screen. Don DeGrady, a screenwriter, and musical composers Richard and Robert Sherman, the iconic Sherman brothers. Pamela finds their presumptions and casual manners highly improper, a view that she also holds of the jocular Walt Disney. Now, Pamela's working relationship with Walt and his team is very difficult from the outset, with her insistence that Mary Poppins is the enemy of sentiment and whimsy. Walt and his staff are puzzled by Pamela's disdain for fantasy, given the nature of the Mary Poppins story, as well as her own rich imagination. In particular, Pamela objects to how the character of George Banks, the children's estranged father, is portrayed, insisting that he is neither cold nor cruel. Over time, the team begins to grasp how deeply personal the Mary Poppins stories are to Pamela, and how many of the characters were inspired by her past. The team acknowledges that Pamela has some valid criticisms, and they begin to make changes, although she becomes increasingly disengaged as painful childhood memories begin to resurface. So, seeking to understand what is bothering her, Walt invites Pamela to Disneyland, which, along with her developing friendship with Ralph, as well as the creative team's revisions to the George Banks character, and the addition of a new song in order to usher in a different ending, helps to dissolve some of Pamela's opposition. Pamela's creativity reawakens, and she begins to collaborate more with the team. Soon afterward, however, Pamela discovers that an animated sequence has been added and becomes enraged. So she confronts Walt and returns home. Walt then discovers that P.L. Travers is a pen name taken from her father, Travers Goff, and that her real name is Helen Goff, and that she is Australian and not English. All of this gives Walt new insight into who Pamela is, and he follows her to London. When Walt arrives unexpectedly at Pamela's home, he begins to share his own less than ideal childhood stories with her, but he stresses the healing value of his art. He urges Pamela not to let the deeply rooted past disappointments dictate her present. That night, after Walt has left, Pamela finally relents and grants the film rights to Disney. We then jump ahead 3 years to 1964. P.L. Travers has begun to write another Mary Poppins story, while the film is getting ready to have its world premiere at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, California. However, Walt has not invited Pamela, fearing how she might react with the press watching. Prompted by Russell, Pamela shows up unannounced at Walt's office, so he reluctantly issues her an invitation. Initially, Pamela watches Mary Poppins with a complete lack of enthusiasm, particularly during the animated sequence. However, she gradually warms up to the rest of the film, becoming deeply moved by the depiction of George Banks's personal crisis as well as his redemption. Ladies and gentlemen, I mentioned in the offset, the beginning of this show, that today's one was going to be a doozy. So let's not waste any further time. Let's go ahead and bring in the man, the myth, the legend, the West Coast professor himself, Jeff Meacham, as well as the stat boy, Mike Caldwell.
Merchandising.
Merchandising? What's that?
Merchandising. Come, I'll show you. Merchandising, merchandising, where the real money's made.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining me once again here on Renegades Reviews. It's the second time we've done this. We've done the whole reunion angle on the show, and it feels good. It feels like it's the right time of the year, you know. As you can see in the background, the parks are decorated for the holidays now. The holidays are all about family.
Oh, what are you doing Christmas? Not even Thanksgiving yet.
Thanksgiving's about family too. Gosh darn it, okay? So we've got the family here to discuss Tom Hanks as Walt Disney. And Jeff, we'll get to you in a minute, but what surprised me was the fact that Stat Boy here, good old Mikey, wanted to be part of this show, because I distinctly remember a time a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away when this bearded wonder down here was a cast member for the Mouse. You know, Uncle Walt, although he had been gone for many a year, was his employer. And
yes, he was.
He had the ability to go to a cast member screening of this film and brought me along with him. So we saw the film, I believe it was like the week before the movie actually came out. But in any event, when we saw it, you were not a big fan of this movie. You did not like it. Dare I say, you hated P.L. Travers.
Yeah.
So let's get right into this. You know, let's cut into this turkey. You know, you want the white meat or the dark meat. What is it about this movie that implored you to come back and discuss it with as much as I know that you disliked it?
Probably to give a little more insight as to my past as a cast member. And as you said, family is everything. So the chance for the three of us to get back together and talk about this stuff like we're in the same room, even though I'm all the way in Tennessee and you guys are still in California, you know, it's basically all that, you know. It's a movie, it's a setting that we all have great stories to tell with. You guys are more Disney than I ever was, because I will admit on camera, I was not the best cast member ever. You guys were learning all the inside stuff. You guys were knowing stuff even before I got to it. And yeah, it irked me a little bit. I was saying, you know, you guys should have been cast members too, because you would have gone off into the stratosphere as far as the Mouse and all that. So I have back for this. This is one of those, like you said, family things. We all love Disney in our own way. I worked there. Jeff just went to the park after all these days and weeks and months, and I'm very happy that you got to go back. You know, Jay, you, Renegade, you love Disney. Natalie loves Disney. You know, you can't hate Disney I did dislike this movie, and we'll get into that a little bit more deeper as we discuss the movie itself. But hey, any chance I get to talk with my brothers about stuff, I love it.
It's fair enough. You mentioned that you're in Tennessee and we're here in California, but Jeff appears to be right outside the Banks home there in jolly old England there, you know. What is it about this film Meacham, that brought you to the camera? Aside from just another day to talk about your love of Disney.
I was going to say, I'm in front of Cherry Tree Lane because half of me is still half friggin' asleep right now after a 16-hour day at the park. plus travel. I've loved Mary Poppins from the very beginning. It is my all-time favorite non-fully animated feature film that the company produced. It is Walt's, for my money, it's Walt's ultimate masterpiece. It is the one that really let him know that he could do things beyond strictly animation. And I think getting that done when he got it done really let him be okay with passing from this existence into another plane, if you will, and letting Roy and the rest of the company move on without him. Can you remember this? Mary Poppins came out in 64 and he was gone by the end of 66. So, and this Mary Poppins very much was a labor of love for him, love of his daughters, love of the story, love of all of that. This movie, the movie that is tells the story of it coming together, I fully expected to be irked at the over dramatization of it. And it was definitely overly dramatic compared to the actual story. Although from what we've been told over the years, Travers was quite dramatic herself anyway, but I loved the framing of the story, and it was just great to see the story go back and forth between where she was in the 60s in her head compared to growing up and why she was the way she was in the 60s. Very great framework by the director and the entire film production team. So that's why I wanted to be on this. Mary Poppins is my jam, and I actually enjoyed this. As far as JJ and I being potential better cast members, you have to remember, Mikey, I actually auditioned. I actually went in for an interview down there at TDA and got turned down flat. So, you know, I wear this because it looks good with my Imagineering polo. Like, really, this is not authentic for what it's worth. I would have loved to have been a cast member, but I'm also a realist and I enjoy living in my own little fantasy land that I did once. So,
yeah. And you also have to remember, Mikey, that I went down there and interviewed as well. And I was told that I was not energetic enough, if anybody knows me and the Disney company, they should know how much love and energy I have for the brand. I mean, our dad's logos are done in Disney font, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah.
For a reason. Yes. There's the W for
absolutely. Walt
and the D for Disney. Like, hello, people. McFly, anybody home?
Yeah, there's a reason my graphics for this entire week on my network have the Disney font to it, because we just love this place, this whole brand so much. So,
well, seriously. If you remember, I had to go back the second time before the 50th had just started. They said I wasn't ready for that. I had to go back 6 months after my first. So I didn't get it on the first one either. I don't know what the politics was before that. So, you know, what I did on the second one was exactly the second interview was exactly what I did on the first one. So I don't know what I did any different to get in. So,
well,
the 50th was desperate times, desperate measures.
The 50th was absolutely bonkers for everybody. Cast members, guests, everybody. It was a complete circus. Because they didn't count on that many people coming in. The 50th, I had never at that point seen the park that attended. It was bananas out here for the 50th, which, God, that's over 15 years ago now, which just makes my go any further, any higher. It was definitely crazy. So I could see why they would maybe say, this guy doesn't look ready to deal with this. By the time it died down, when you went back, maybe it'll make more sense. Anyway, as we do on JJ's channel, on our shows, we're off the rails here. So,
rain is off. It's okay, because it all ties back to the love of Disney.
Right.
You know, Saving Mr. Banks, Jeff, you alluded to how it kind of bounces back and forth between the 60s and where P.L. Travers has come on her journey, and then back to the early turn of the century with young Helen Goff going through her experiences and everything that helped essentially shape her stories and her characters.
Yep.
You know, I love the fact that we really get a good sense as to where a lot of these characters that we now know and love came from. That was one of the things that really endeared me to the story.
Absolutely.
And Mikey, we'll start with you. You know, out of all the characters from Saving Mr. Banks, which we eventually then see inspired the Mary Poppins characters, which one did you like seeing the inspiration for the most?
I would have to go with Travers Goff himself, because I believe he is the keystone. He is the main brick in the wall. He is the piece to all of it. You know, the relationship that Helen and Travers had, you know, that expands through time. Daddies and children, daddies and kids. So it was one of those moments, and I think it was one of the toughest watch. And I believe it was the scene at the fair where things started to go down with his drinking problem, with his injuries, getting sick and all that. I mean, at the end, that of course is definitely the saddest part when Travers died. That was the saddest, but getting to that point, yeah, it was just, it was a teary moment, absolutely, but I prefer to focus on, you know, them playing in the front yard, trying to catch the hen, riding horses. Do you like why he shaves? Do you like silky kisses or scratchy ones? Those little moments, that's what gets you here, and that's what I liked so much.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I was gonna mention that back to you since you mentioned the whole Travers Goff character and the part of the whole thing with her not wanting Mr. Banks to have the mustache. You know, it goes back to that scene with her and her dad. You know, why do you shave like that? You know, well, do you prefer silky kisses or do you prefer scratchy kisses? Well, then this is what a father must do if just to spare his daughter's cheeks. You know,
right.
Everything that we learned about and we saw in the past tied to something in the modern day in the story. And yep. I don't know how many people really pick up on that the first time through, unless you do like I did, like I know Jeff did, and that's to follow it right up with Mary Poppins afterwards.
Right.
Jeff, same question to you. You know, out of all the characters that we got kind of the inspiration for within Saving Mr. Banks, which one did you enjoy seeing, you know, kind of the rooting of and where that characterization came from?
I hate to seem like a bandwagoner, but I have two, and the first one was going to be Travers anyway because of the development of the story. And that scene where Emma Thompson, God love her for being in this movie, she's so good in everything she does, talking about, you know, the change in the story of the movie where Mr. Banks is redeemed, and just it was so important to her that he have that better ending than her own father did. And that may, as a father now, I was a father by the time this movie came in anyway, but as a father looking back at that, it just makes me openly weep every time I see that scene. I also, and I forget the Danny's name, so forgive me. so forgive me for this. Helen's real life nanny when she comes in, who is the inspiration for Mary Poppins. And if you read the books, which I highly recommend, by the way, the Mary Poppins character is very much more grounded and very much more non-whimsical in the stories and in her real life compared to what we saw in 1964 and whenever Returns came out.
Returns was 2017.
Thank you. Much less of the magical whimsy and the magic tricks, period. Obviously, in real life, you're not going to see that at the turn of the century. But even in the stories that P.L. Travers wrote, Mary Poppins is much more grounded, much more gruff and stiff and just kind of not snooty, because that seems even bad even for her, but just a very different character. And I liked how she took the character, the person that was her nanny that was brought in to help take care of the family in the wake of Travers' illness, wove that into her stories, and then Walt's brain and his creative team, of course, took it a whole other way. And it was cool to see and realize as a reader of the books that character's evolution was really neat to see unfold.
Yeah, I mean, P.L. even says herself in the film that Mary Poppins is the enemy of sentiment and whimsy.
Yes.
And just to correct you, it wasn't her nanny. It was her aunt, her mother's sister, Aunt Ellie.
Yeah, her mother's sister.
That came to help during Travers' illness. And Travers, if you remember, he wanted no part of Ellie. He's like, please, God, not Ellie. Because a lot of the reason, you know, that you just said, how stern and strict and grounded she was, and Travers had always been that imagination, that beacon to help kind of inspire PL's mind to just run crazy. For me, I think, you know, first of all, seeing that her own nanny was called Katie Nana.
Right.
As they're leaving the house, like, that was so cool to me.
Yes.
That she just straight up lifted that, put it right in the story.
That's where I got mixed up.
And then Uncle Albert. You know,
the horse? Said
that the horse was Uncle Albert, that it had been transformed into the horse because they hated his laugh. And then you think about Mary Poppins and you think about Uncle Albert, the great Ed Wynn. What's his song? I Love to Laugh.
Yep.
You know, it's just those little things that, again, when you watch them back to back, you can pick up on that stuff.
Yeah,
but if you just watch one or the other, like the whole Uncle Albert thing probably gets glossed over.
Definitely.
Unless you pay close attention. It's like, wait a minute, Uncle Albert, that's the Ed Wynn character.
Yes.
And then, of course, Mr. Dawes at the bank being Mr. Bell Hatchet, the manager of Travers's bank.
Yes. Just those great.
There might have been a couple others, but those were the main ones that I really picked up on. Can't even say how many times I've watched Mary Poppins. Obviously, saving Mr. Banks, it's less. I've probably watched it at least a good 10 times, maybe a dozen. But those are the main ones that I really pick up on watching the two stories.
Definitely.
Another thing that I, well, before we get there, let's talk about some of the people that PL encounters in the story once she comes to Hollywood. You know, Don, the Sherman brothers, Ralph, you know, all of these central characters that really kind of help chisel away at her exterior and her wall, you know, and first, it's the Sherman brothers, I think, that really start to make way with their they're gorgeous tunes. And, you know, I mean, the Sherman Brothers, we could sit here all day praising the Sherman Brothers and their musical abilities. Yeah. But
especially after me going there yesterday.
Out of the songs for the film, what would you say is your favorite, Mikey?
Oh, as much as I love that the happy-go-lucky and all the popish tunes, you know, of Go Fly a Kite, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, it's got to be Tuppence, Feed the Birds, because I love the backstory of it. I love the scene in the movie where Richard is playing the piano, playing the song. And I just love the story that they taught us at Disney University that when Walt heard the song, he loved it so much that whenever he was having a bad day and Richard and Robert were working, all he'd have to do is just go up to them and just say two words, play it. And immediately Richard would belt out Tuppence a Bag. It's got so much power to it. Yes, it can be a lullaby. Yes, it can be a calming song. And we just watched the movie before. I'll admit it. I teared up. It got to me. It's one of the. I'm not much of a crier during movies. It's a beautiful, well written song, and I love the story behind it. And I believe I've done this many times in the La Grande Californian. We would go up to the piano player, have him play songs. And I think it worked once. And I said those two words. I said, play it. And the piano player just went right into it. I sat in the chair. And whatever day I was having, if it was a bad day or a stressful day or a long day, it just melted all away. So Tuppence Feed the Birds. Tuppence a Bag. Okay. Loved it.
What's your least favorite song in the movie? It's hard, I know.
Think if I did, songs it, are it so is, great. It really is. Probably I would want to say that the one that I didn't really get to was probably Fiduciary Bank. Because I like the little comedy bits in this with Dick Van Wilder Senior Dawes, that kind of brought it up. But the actual it seemed like it was a little bit too stern and stiff, you know, because it's about business, it's about money, it's about finance.
It's supposed to be children. It's about all those topics. It's the complete antithesis of Feed the Birds.
That's probably where I lost interest. There's that one part in almost every movie where you lose interest or you just don't pay attention to it. So when that sequence was happening, minus the funny parts, I think that's the song. Yeah, I'm going to go with that.
But see, as far as Saving Mr. Banks goes, I kind of love how they bounce back and forth between the Shermans playing it and kind of creating it. And then it bounces back to the carnival in Australia and Colin Farrell being involved in it as Travers Goff. Like, I can see how in the realm of the actual Poppins movie, you don't get it and get into it that much, but granted, we're touching on Poppins, but the focal point is Saving Mr. Banks. The way they edited it within the confines of that film, I think kind of made it a little bit more entertaining than its original outing in the 64 Mary Poppins movie.
I gotcha.
Personally. Jeff, we're going to swing it over to you. Same two questions. First thing first, what is your favorite song from the film? And then you can just immediately follow it right up with your least favorite song.
I'm going to break format on your show. If you want to fire me, go ahead. My least favorite is Mikey Page took my answers. Fidelity Fiduciary Bank. I like that song, but you're asking for my least favorite. It's like asking me my my most favorite Disney thing, or my least favorite Disney thing. It's like, they're all great. What are you talking about? It's like pulling off a limb. It's just not, it's not as fun as the other songs. As far as my favorite, again, you know, Mikey touched on it. I have known the story about Walt asking the Shermans to play Tuppence a Bag, Feed the Rose, whatever, whatever you want to call it. Since I didn't even get as far as Disney University and taking the courses and whatever. So I showed it yesterday on my on our special for Mickey and for the company as a whole. Walt's light being on throughout this whole pandemic nonsense was really reassuring to everybody that saw it. Walt's presence is very reassuring even now, and people are going to say I'm being way too sentimental for a P.L. Travers story, but just every time I hear that song now, whether it's, you know, on a radio or just happen across it on YouTube or some reason, I get the misties every time. And when I was making the playlist for us to listen to on the way down there, because the original plan was for Dylan and I to, you know, take the transit all the way down and all the way back, you know, Tuppence a Bag was one of the first songs I put on the list, just because it's Walt's song. And that's ultimately the bottom line. That's why I get so sentimental about Snow White and her being removed from different things around the parks, because that's Walt's princess, damn it. Same with this song. This song, you know, as great as it is just as a song, definitely holds a higher place than most in the Disney and the discography because of its place in Walt's heart. So that's why it's my favorite.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, at least we're going to have some different answers on this program. My favorite song, as far as Poppins goes, is Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. But within the realms of Saving Mr. Banks, it's Let's Go Fly a Kite.
Yeah.
Because that moment...
The song that broke the P.L. Travers.
Exactly. That moment is what really made the Grinch's heart grow 3 sizes that day.
Yes.
You know, as adamant as she had been about all the stuff they were doing to her characters, when she sat there and she saw that they had given Mr. Banks his redemption arc and he mends the kite, and you can just see the joy overtaking her to the point where she's sitting there tapping her toe.
Yep.
Which Don, of course, notices.
Oh, yeah.
And he grabs her and they begin dancing around the rehearsal room. Something that an hour and a half prior, you never thought you would have seen.
Nope. It's that moment in the film where, as she unsoftens and she gets mad again later, that moment pisses her off in her own mind because she let that happen, as far as like, I let my guard down. Damn him. Damn that Disney and damn those people. It's like, no, I don't want to be, you know, guard down. I want
to
be.
Well, she tried to revert back. I mean, immediately as soon as the song ended, she tried to.
Right.
In there. Well, let's do the English. Let us go and fly a kite, but oh, maybe I'll just let it go. You know, I mean, yeah, she couldn't do it. She had to finally submit.
Exactly. And then the flip side of the coin,
exactly.
The song that I always liked the least, and it's more in the Poppins realm, but it ties into my favorite. It's Step in Time.
Really?
And I know that may be kind of sacrilege, but I just feel like the entire sequence goes way too long.
Yes.
Yeah.
However, if you notice, Mary starts tapping her foot very akin to PL's in Saving Mr. Banks.
Yes.
Just another little tie, a little nod to the two stories. But yeah, Step in Time has always been one of my least favorite ones. Again, the whole scene as a whole is cool, but it just drags way too long.
Yes.
You cut that scene in half, you got a great song. A great moment.
It's funny you mentioned the toe tapping, because you notice when Mary up to that point in the Mary Poppins movie had been fantasy and whimsical, but not like over the top, like I don't give it what the father says. When he demands an explanation for all the chimney sweeps and the hoopla, I never explained anything. And she walks back upstairs like, yep, I did it. And he's like, damn, I guess. So very much like P.L. Travers, where she's got the guard up and then she, starts to, and she lets her, Mary lets her hair down, proverbially, and gets into the whole scene. And then she's right back to Mary Poppins like, yeah, I did it. And walk back up the stairs. And George is just.
So would that have also happened in the scene after taking the medicine before Stay Awake, denying that all the stuff in the chalk drawing happened?
Yes. Again, that's Mary's trying to keep things level, even keel, and not have the imaginations go too wide. I think it's a great when, and again, they didn't think about this in 1964, but when you look back and say Mr. Banks, it's definitely an allusion to her trying to find the balance between the whimsy and the reality. And Mary just keeping the kids, okay, sure, and making them go to sleep. It was that moment where JJ made it a perfect point. Both Travers and Poppins, tapping their foot there along for whatever song it would have been, that was the moment where the guard came down, even for a brief period. So again, a great tie-in that, when you think about and you look back on both films, you go, okay, I see where they went with this, both in the telling of P.L. Travers' story and in the over-dramatization of P.L. Travers' story and tying it into Mary Poppins, probably more than it actually was.
In some cases, and under-dramatizing in others, because
right,
as we heard in the years since this movie, that they, as harsh as they made P.L. Travers, they made her softer than she really was.
Yes,
which is very interesting to me, because I know that's part of why Mikey didn't like it right out the gate, is because they made her such a royal bee in this movie.
Yeah,
that was my initial opinion, and I have said it many times that if it was not for Tom Hanks' portrayal as Walt Disney, I would have gotten up like she did. Like Travers did in reality, at the premiere, she did walk out of the movie because she just couldn't take it anymore. And I was just sitting there, and I'm thinking, you've got this guy, you've got Walt Disney, who wants to make the children happy, who wants, take the business side out of it, take the business out, take money out, take the all that business financial empire out, and look at just the piece where he wants to make the promise to his daughters about taking the story, taking Mary Poppins out of the book and putting her on the camera, putting her on film. She's going to fly into your TV screens eventually. Look at that. And I get it. I get it so many times. It's taken me years to get it. Emily, it's her work. And to just flat out say, no, I want it this way, like a stubborn little five-year-old, because that's what I was seeing. I was seeing 5-7-year-old Ginty almost throwing a tantrum. And I'm like, he's trying so hard to melt her down, break her down, to get the film rights, to make something beautiful, to make people happy. And she's just like, no, I want, like the scene, I don't want the color red. I mean, and Walt getting right, he's like, is this a test, Pamela? You can't make a movie without red. He threw out, it's like a battle. Walt eventually won the battle. But it's like he was firing everything at her. You can't, buses in London are red. There's red in the British flag. Mailboxes are red. Mary Poppins wore red in the step in time sequence. Hello, you gotta break at some point. You gotta give in, and she finally did. So kudos to Tom Hanks for that.
Well, kudos for Walt Disney for that. But I mean, right. You know,
yeah, that too.
You touched on it and how you finally understand it, and I'm glad you finally understand it. You know, you've got to keep in a perspective the key line in the entire movie. The Bankses are family. The Bankses are family to me. And the moment that you can comprehend that, everything turns into a whole new light.
Yep.
Because I've talked to you about this 100 times. You know, you're not a violent person by nature. You are non-confrontational. No. But I have seen you get pissed when it comes to your family.
Oh, yeah.
And that's all that Pamela was doing, is she was taking every step to protect her Aunt Ellie, Travers Goff, and all the people that meant something to her in real life, because those people transcended into living forever as they've now been immortalized as these characters. Jeff, your thoughts?
It's funny. So this last weekend, Sylvester Stallone released the director's cut of Rocky IV. I always think about the Rocky story when we talk about stuff like this, because Sly was perfectly fine with taking Rocky's script and burying it with himself in his backyard if he couldn't play Rocky. He had to have it his way. If you look back now and think of anybody else playing Rocky Balboa, it doesn't work. It just flat out doesn't work without that Sylvester Stallone voice performance, whatever you want to call it. He's Rocky Balboa. He is the character. You know, Travers here, she doesn't want to have her characters, you know, I don't think the actual phrase Disney-ized was used, but that's exactly what they became, you know, to a certain extent. But if you watch that movie compared to the other live actions he did, the other animated movies he's done over the year, that they've done over the years, and the hybrids, Mary Poppins itself very much is more of a, I'll say more grounded story, because I already used that word before, but you can definitely see the bits of reality compared to fantasy that they tried very hard to balance. Much like the later Pete's Dragon, which I absolutely have adored my entire life. Pete's Dragon's very much a reality, you know, like Pete's life sucks up until the point he meets Elliot. And, you know, and even, you know, the whole story of trying to get free from the Gogans once and for all, and Elliot at the end, letting Pete know that you've got your family now, you don't need me. That's very much what Mary Poppins was in the actual Mary Poppins movie. She shows up when the shit has hit the fan and the family needs fixing. And then when the family is repaired, she's like, okay, I can go help somebody else. And you notice she doesn't return for whatever it is, 25 years, until the Banks' children are in such dire straits that it's almost, you know, she knows. I think that Pamela behind it, writing it, basing it on her family, her acquaintances, her people in her life, felt the need to protect with every fiber of her being, with every last breath she had, to make sure that the whimsy of Walt did not overtake the the powerful of Pamela and the storytelling. And I think they found a good balance at the end. You know, the movie version, she's mad. She walks out. She wants to walk out and she doesn't. And then she tries to, you know, argue about it. And, you know, he tells her, you know, Pamela, the ship has sailed. It was indeed much more intense than the real life. I mean, she was fit to be tied, so much so that any rights to any future Mary Poppins stories were completely out of Walt's hands and Disney Company's hands until as recently as when Mary Poppins Returns was developed. That was a long damn time between those two movies because of the relationship and the breaking down of it between Pamela and Walt.
There you go. The one other character that I really want to talk about in Saving Mr. Banks, you know, as much as the Sherman brothers and even Don to a lesser extent were able to help soften Pam, we got to talk about Ralph, the limo driver.
Oh, my God, yes.
And, you know, I've said this many a time on these shows. Paul Giamatti usually plays such a prick that it's hard to love him in anything.
Yes.
But I'll be damned if he wasn't the best character in this movie. At least in my opinion, you know, because he starts off waiting there at the airport, pick her up, you know, Walt Disney presents P.L. Travers. Oh, he does he? You know, and he's already got that road ahead of him.
Yes.
And slowly but surely, he gets inside of her. And aside from the Shermans, you know, maybe even before the Shermans, he gets inside of her because of that bond they build every day with him driving her to the studio and then back to her hotel. And the bond that they develop all the way up until when she finally comes back for the premiere. Who's the one that shuttles her to the premiere? Who's the one telling her, you know, I thought a friend of mine could use a ride? Who's the one hyping her up, telling her, this is your night, go get it? It's all Ralph. Mikey, what do you think about the Ralph character and his relation to Pamela?
If Ralph was the model cast member, if there was a model cast member that Walt wanted back in the day or even now, it would definitely be at the top of the list. He was a very polite character. He was a very respectable character, meaning he gave Pamela every inch of respect, no matter what the cost. He was cheerful. He was happy, equal what a cast member is supposed to be. Regardless of the situation, regardless of the situation, they taught us that at Disney, you're supposed to be polite at all times, you're supposed to be happy at all times, and you're supposed to be respectful at all times. And he did that no matter what. He never got cross with her. He never got angry with her. He might have gotten a little bit frustrated with her. More than likely the scene when they talked about the weather in Los Angeles, the sun brings life and rain brings life. There might have been a little hint of a disagreement there. But he would have if there was a cast member award for Paul Giamatti, I would give that to him hands down.
Would that award be named after, and forgive me if I am incorrect about the cast member's name, I want to say it's Oscar, the long-tenured chef there?
I would think so, yes. Oscar was a very humble cast member. Yes, his name was Oscar. Yes, I don't remember his last name, but if he was there prior to day one, You know, he was definitely one of the nicest gentlemen ever to work in the park. And I got to see him on more than one occasion. And I get humbled sometimes. And boy, when I first met him, I almost was in tears when I heard it. When I first heard his story and then I finally saw him, I'm like, what? I even asked him, I'm like, what do I have to do to be like you? And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you've come to work every day since for 55 years. What do I have to do to met? And he's like, one, don't think about it. Don't focus on that goal. Just come to work. And I think he was even mimicking what Walt said. Respect the guests. Be happy with your job. And you'll have a long life with it. So, yes, there was an award for that, and we name it the Oscar 60-Year Cast Member Guy Award. Give it to him.
Jeff, damn it, your thoughts on Ralph?
Well, I have two different...
Wait a minute. We broke Mikey on Saving Mr. Banks?
Oh, shit. Here we go.
Yo, I don't want to cry on camera. I'm sorry.
So I actually have two different characters that really hit home for me on a level that I don't think, at least the second character, people don't really understand. They will because it's me, but not because of the movie. So, of course, Ralph. I mean, he was, from what we've been told, an amalgamation of several different limo drivers, but they all treated PL with respect and, you know, did their best to soothe the savage beast, if you will. Throughout the course of the making of the film. So I definitely, it was nice. It was wonderful to see Paul Giamatti in a role where he didn't want to punch him in his face. Definitely a great switch from the usual. Something that I noticed in the movie, though, and I had to go back and watch to make sure I was correct. That's why my head was down during Mikey's description. So I apologize. I loved that in the movie. I don't know if it actually happened in the real premiere or not. In the movie, when they're all going in and Pamela has crashed the premiere, there's Mickey offering her his arm and walking in with her when nobody else would, because she still felt like an outsider and not wanted there. And the symbol of Walt himself, come on in. It was just so neat. It was a nice touch. Again, I don't know if it actually happened. I doubt it.
I don't think it did either. I think that was something for the movie.
It was still super sweet and a great nod to her, to the character in the movie, and to the overall presentation, because we talked about it a lot yesterday in the course of the hour stream we did and the 16 hours I was there, which, like I said, I'm still...
Thank God for pre-tape, folks.
Right? Mickey is the symbol of the company. He always has been. He always will be. And to have the symbol of the character... the very symbol of Walt himself, offer P.L. Travers that welcoming arm to hold tight to and to walk into that, what could have been a lion's den of a premiere, was very, very sweet and a very nice touch by the filmmakers.
Well, that's what's always made the whole poster so amazing, too, is the fact that in Walt's shadow there you see Mickey Mouse, and in P.L.'s shadow there you see Mary Poppins. Yes. And the last time I can really think of where that was done to such a tremendous degree was the episode 1 Phantom Menace poster, where you saw young Anakin, but the shadow cast was Darth Vader.
Yes.
You know, so that's just one of the many reasons why I've always loved these posters. But I mean, You're dead on about Ralph. You know, the fact that I can actually sit down and watch a Paul Giamatti movie and not want to punch him in his face. The only other movie I can think of where I don't want to is when he's playing Bob Zemuda in Man on the Moon.
Well, again, but I don't
blame almost him. Everything else I've seen him in, you just want to reach, you know, ball up a fist. Reach way back and assert yourself.
Yes.
You know, just have your way with him. And especially here in the last 10 or so years.
Well, it's funny. I didn't mind him as Santa in Fred Claus. He did a good job in that, but it was still kind of iffy. The first time I ever saw Paul in the movie was Howard Stern's Private Parts movie, which, oh my God, let's take turns punching that shithead. Jiminy crickets.
Antichrist.
To see him evolve from that, you know, back in 1997, here we are, you know, 20 years after the fact, playing this beautiful man, this wonderful character. Again, very, very, very great. Very nice to see him play such a sweetheart. When, like you said, usually it's like, oh God, here's Paul Giamatti. Here we go.
Whose daughter, ironically, in the movie was named Jane.
Yes.
Another nice little touch, I'm sure,
to the story. I have loved so much how they've preserved the legacy of Mary Poppins and the Travers story between this, the different little nice little touches in Mary Poppins Returns. That's why I say this is my favorite movie as far as Mary Poppins goes. St. Mr. Banks is wonderful. I definitely will give it the grade. I give it here momentarily. But again, Mary Poppins was Walt's masterpiece. It was his final, you know, other than starting Walt Disney World's creation, which, God, 50 years this year, by the way, Walt Disney World. Holy moly. This movie is Walt's everything he had moment movie. So that's why Mr. Banks is so important to me as a fan, because it tells the story of him wearing himself the hell out to get this done.
I'm glad you just brought that up, because I'm going to be a little Debbie Downer here for a minute. We're going to get on a little bit morbid. Do we feel as a panel here that Walt's pursuit of these stories and everything that it took to get it done helped lead to his death just a couple of years later? Granted, he was a heavy smoker, so I'm sure there were other underlying issues with him. But when you think about the fact that just about two years after this film was finally made, I've done it. I've kept my promise to my kids. I've accomplished my 20-year mission. Like Jeff said, I can go now. This film is very much Walt's legacy. More so than Snow White, Fantasia, the parks itself. This film is very much Walt's legacy. Thoughts? We'll go to Mikey. Blurted out emphatically no while I was talking, so we'll go to you first, Mikey.
I'm saying no because you got to put in the work, but I don't think it was the work that led to whatever health decline, lungs, or heavy smoking. I have to disagree with that. I mean, yes, I will admit frustrating. You know, he said it, you know, when he was having the meeting, you know, I would have saved myself an ulcer in 20 years of work. I believe it was his life choices. If that part of his life, the smoking and all that stuff, if he would not have done that, I believe he could have kept going at least another 10 years. And he could have added more to his story. So I have to disagree with that one, bro. I'm sorry.
No. It's all fine. We are all entitled to our opinions. You know, we always love to say on these channels, subjective. One of the things that really made me think about this, though, is that a lot of people on the inside of another company with an iconic fantasy character who I love and adore even more so than Mickey the Mouse, this one being an amphibian, a frog of sorts, tend to believe that Jim's negotiations with Eisner and the Disney company in trying to get that deal done kind of led towards his passing there. So it's part of what made me think about this in a similar vein. Jeff, your opinions.
Oh, Lord. Okay, so I'm a yes and no person. I know it sounds wishy-washy. Yes, I definitely think this wore him down. I also think his decision to take on the Walt Disney World project right after this definitely didn't help. Those last 2 years of him, you know, making the plans and, you know, getting the property bought down in Central Florida and everything that went along with it was the biggest hastener, I think, of the cancer just breaking him down. And I know that sounds like it's, yes, cancer is what got him. Okay, cool. I get that. I'm not a doctor. I understand that. But the exhaustion that was brought on by getting this done, by the start of the Florida negotiations, and just all the secrecy and all the drama that went into starting Walt Disney World into being a thing. Again, he died 2 years after this, which was when Disney World had basically just broken ground. He didn't visit the property down in Central Florida until after everything was already bought. So he's having this stuff bought sight basically unseen by himself. He passes during the construction of Walt Disney World. Roy, God bless his brother Roy, the finance guy, you know, is not the creative guy that Walt is by any means. Walt Disney World opens in 71. Roy's gone 6 months later. It's not a coincidence for me that both of them passed shortly after they got their "I did it" moment. Same with Jim, like you said, Jay. You know, Jim, you know, granted, they didn't get the deal done in Jim's lifetime. It took another, you know, 13 years or whatever it was. But people understand how, and again, they might. If you're watching this, you might understand. I don't know. How strenuous business discussions, negotiations, deal making is on a person's heart. Not the broken heart, what was me, the actual physical organ. That's
especially when the character, especially when the character is something you hold so personal to you.
Exactly.
Like Mary Poppins, like Kermit the Frog and the rest of the Muppet Clan.
Yep.
You know, it's not just some random creation, it's a part of you.
It's family.
The Muppets, I feel like, yeah. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was gonna say, yeah. The Muppets have always been family for all of us. The Muppets was Jim's family. The people behind the puppets, the actual Muppets themselves, all family. Mary Poppins and her troop of characters is very much Shriver's family. The Mickey Mouse Club core, the Sensational Six, very much Walt's, you know. So just all these things that lead to business discussion. I mean, this whole thing about the Steamboat Willie going into public domain in the next little while here has been crazy on the company. But it's not crazy on the company like it would have been if Walt was still in charge. That's the difference. These characters, these people are very much attached at the very soul to what, to who they were born from. And, you know, so to answer your question about what time it is by telling you how to build the watch, yes, I think it did definitely hasten his departure.
All right. I think this is as good a time as any to begin the wrap up. I've been talking now for well over an hour. Right. These gentlemen have been joining me for roughly an hour, and we still haven't even given our ratings on this film. You know, I'm going to go to Mikey first, because this is the man that wanted to walk out of the cast exclusive screening because he hated it that much. Mikey, after, you know, 8 years of this movie being in existence, after just watching it once again before you sat down with us to do this today, out of 5 stars, no quarters or 3/4, you can give halves. What do you give Saving Mr. Banks?
4.5 stars. There's still that little part of me that want to go all the way and give it 5. You know, if you asked me this question when I first saw the movie, I would be below the 4s. I would say 3.5. After learning, after talking with you guys, after seeing it again, I brought it up. So I'm going 4.5. Like I say, it's just that nagging little P.L. Travers character. And I mean, she did such a good job. It's such a good job. It's too good. It's too good. If she could have toned it down just a little bit, it would be 5. But I got to go 4.5.
Okay. Jeff, I'm sure I don't even have to ask you, but go ahead and tell the people what you give it.
Well, I might surprise you, Jay. I'm going to say 4.5 as well.
Wow, okay.
And again,
really? Wow.
You don't let me do quarters. Otherwise, I would do 4.75. I love this movie. I always will. But I feel that the parts that they over-dramatized, or in fact, under-dramatized, the fact they just didn't tell the story, and again, they're movie makers. They have to make it more, you know, appealing for the people sitting there for 2 hours or whatever. I would have kept the story more grounded to what it actually was, and not, you know, even 1964, you can't have us believe that she hadn't signed the rights over yet during the whole, you don't make a movie without signing the rights over. That's just not the way it's done in 1964, 1924, 1994, 2024. It doesn't work that way. That part I was like, really? Other than that, like I said, 4.75 if I could, but if I can't, 4.5.
Okay. Fair enough. That brings it to me, and for me, it's a 5-star.
Oh, okay.
For me, this is one of Tom Hanks's best performances.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
We have to keep in mind we're in the midst of Tom Hanks month. So some of the focus has to be more on him and his performance as Walt, even though it's very much Emma Thompson's movie.
Right.
But 5 out of 5 stars for me, you know, whether it's over or under dramatized, whether things have been changed to alter the truth a little bit so that the legacy of P.L. Travers isn't of her being this raging bee all the time, I feel like the story that was told was perfect. It hits every note you want it to hit. It establishes where the characters for Mary Poppins comes from, why they're so important, why she holds them so dear. It hits you in all the right places to where I openly cried during numerous moments in this movie. And I mean, it's just iconic. Walt Disney and Tom Hanks's portrayal. Tom Hanks has now portrayed Walt Disney, and he's portrayed somebody that, Stat Boy, you'll be back later this month to join me when we discuss again. You know, he's played Mr. Rogers now.
As well. Tomorrow, baby.
You know, we've got him playing two iconic men who have helped shape at least my childhood in life. And I'm sure your guys's and our numerous fans out there as well. You know, so it's hard for me to think of this film as anything less than a 5-star classic, in my opinion.
If we're going based on Tom Hanks as Walt Disney, can I go Meltzer and go 6 out of 5? I mean, really. Yeah. I mean, him as Walt, shoot. Put him in every Disney movie ever from now on. Like, seriously, have a Stan Lee cameo session with freaking Walt Disney walking through every damn movie now. I'm okay with that. 100% okay with that. If we're going just off Tom, dude, it's 5 out of 5 every day. Overall story, you know, 4. If I could, it'd be 3/4, but it's 4.5. So that's. But yeah, Tom is Walt. My God, he was so good.
He was so good that I was very upset that I did not get to see him in the park while they were filming. I couldn't go anywhere near Main Street, and I couldn't go anywhere near the carousel. And I was so disappointed in that. I wanted to see him while I was working there, and I would have literally hit the ground crying, because I would not have called him Tom Hanks. I would have called him Walt. I have to get that part out there. It was, I believe, 2013 or 2014 when the principal filming was taking place. And to just to have seen that, all those extras in the movie that were walking along Main Street and riding the carousel, they got the greatest Disney experience you could ever get in the 2010s. To be transported back to 1961 Disneyland and to see Walt Disney there in the park, even though with Tom Hanks, we know this, that is as high as you can go, I believe. And I wanted to soak, if I wanted to almost break protocol, and I just wanted to go up and just look him in the eye. And I would have melted at that point. That would have been a cast member's dream.
I'm right there with you. I'm right there with you.
Probably would have shat my pants, not gonna lie. Probably when I got even cold enough where I could have, you know, without having to smell reach his nose, poor guy. Cause I mean, that's as close as we're ever going to get in our lifetimes to meeting Walt, because he was gone long before any of us came around. So that would have been really sweet.
Yeah.
Half happened. But, you know, yeah. It is what it is, as we say around here.
Mikey, we've already touched that we'll be seeing you again on this channel on the 27th as me and you discuss Tom Hanks as Fred Rogers in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. What else have you got coming up on the horizon here in the next few weeks?
Just continuing with Statboy Sports Bar and continuing with football and continuing with wrestling. We're right in the middle of Smoky Mountain Christmas at work. And then finally, after the first of the year, I finally get a break. So that's what's coming up. Other than that, it's just good old fashioned me. That's all I got. Okay.
Sounds good. And Jeff, you know, we'll be seeing you here on the channel once again at the end of the month on the 30th, as me and you will be discussing the Polar Express.
Yes.
Definitely looking forward to that one. Other than that, what have you got going on the Jeff Meacham Network?
Well, this is the end of Disney week. It's been a great week. I've enjoyed every bit of it. I enjoyed working with, you know, Statboy this last Tuesday on the show, and Greg Cherry Wednesday, being at the parks yesterday, which again, the sleep deprivation is real. Tomorrow, watch along of Impact Wrestling's Turning Point pay-per-view. Sunday, watch along of Survivor Series. Help me. Monday, Mikey forgot to mention, we're actually having Statboy Sports Bar at a special day Monday at 6:30 Eastern because he can't do it Tuesday. So we're actually doing Statboy Sports Bar on Aaron's birthday. So that'll be interesting to see if we can maybe get Aaron in for a brief sports cameo here, right? We'll try, though. I'll bug a shit out of him because I will. But yes, we're in the midst of a 12-day-in-a-row streak for me that I've got something going on. It'll be next Friday when you and I present Dad's Always on Wrestling Best Moments from the Best Matches from the Undertaker. That'll be my last day where there's something definitive. A lot of things going on. There you go.
Okay.
Good job, Jeff.
Thank you.
Sounds good. Well, gentlemen, we've been talking for almost an hour and a half now by the time everything gets edited in and everything. So thank you both for joining me for this very special episode. Again, it's always nice when we can get the family together to not be dysfunctional and, you know, come together like we're supposed to celebrate these things. Make sure you guys tune in tomorrow as I'll be discussing Bridge of Spies.
Ooh.
A very cool World War II era spy flick that I just watched. I still need to write my review and everything as we are filming this.
Right.
But But rest assured, everything will be together to go for that. But looking forward to covering that one tomorrow, right back here on the Casa D18 Studios channel, right back here on an all-new Renegades Reviews. To all my loyal fans and viewers out there that have tuned in for the premiere, watching along, leaving your thoughts and comments all the way over there next to Jeffy and Mikey. Thank you very much. Wrong way, Mikey. There you go. Thank you very much for joining us today. Likewise, all the loyal fans and viewers that tune in just a little bit later in the day, watching on demand, leaving your thoughts and comments underneath the tracks of Main Street there. Thank you very much. Greatly appreciate each and every one of you. I know all three of us appreciate all of our loyal fans
yes.
that tune in on a regular basis and join us for whether it's an appetizer and an ice cold beverage on the sports bar, or you grabbing your Pepsi and your concessions from the snack bar to watch an episode of Renegades Reviews, or whatever you've got on deck when Jeff decides he gets an itch and wants
every
to
other damn thing I do.
Yeah. As he does, you know, sometimes randomly streams while he washes dishes and stuff. So
hey. I was bored, whatever.
We all enjoy you guys tuning in and boosting those viewership hours, you know, still trying to get myself monetized here. Thank you all for tuning in and joining us today. And the three of us, we will all see you next time.